Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very pleased. I have a great writer across from me at the table. It's James McCourt. His newest book is an anatomy of nostalgia called Lasting City. And I think that he's one of the great living writers of our time, and for that reason I was particularly eager to talk to him about this extraordinary high wire act in which a young boy grows to be a 70-year-old man. He is at his mother's deathbed, and his mother says, tell everything. Tell it all. Now, you know, we think we know what tell everything means. You know, the usual stories. But James McCourt is a literalist. So what does tell everything mean?
It's the complicated story of a marriage which was bumpy, and three boys who were raised in it, a father who becomes impoverished when his bank closes in the 30s, has a nervous breakdown. The mother is forced to go to work, and she goes to work for a furrier called L.B. Furriers down in the Fur District. And she's a traveling saleswoman because rich women always bought furs. And she had a partner. And along the way, they had an affair. I didn't find out about it until years later when a woman called me and said, I cannot carry this on my shoulders. It's not my business. You've got to know what went on. So I met with Kathleen, may she rest in peace, and she unloaded the whole thing. And I said, what a story. And then there were other things about it. My mother had a chance, a real chance, at having passed a screen test in Astoria, at becoming one of the sort of replacements for the dreadful Mary Miles Minter, who shot and killed William Desmond Taylor. And they made long-haired girl pictures for a couple of years after that, but then they found Clara Bow and everything turned around. But Catherine Kitty, as she was called, Kitty Moore.
What a movie star name. Kitty Moore.
Can you imagine?
It's such. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You say to her doctor,
yeah,
when she's in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
He notices his name is Dr. Handel.
Yeah.
And Kitty says, Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Yeah,
and but, he immediately identifies her as a sharp-witted woman.
Right. And so all they said was, well, cut her hair, and we'll have a star, you know. And I said, well, what kind of a, they were going to California bit by bit at that time. And they said, well, you know, what do we do? We'll do with her. Well, yeah, she's good, you know. She's got life. She's got it. Look at that camera. Look at that, you know, the camera loves her. And her father, my grandfather,
said
absolutely forbade it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Scotched it.
So let's see what we have here. We have here a woman who could have been a movie star,
yeah,
and who remains for her life the star of her movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A young boy who sees his mother's starring side.
Yeah.
She is a monster and a movie star.
Right.
And he remembers her that way. And he remembers the first time he heard about Hiroshima. And his mother is talking about the fireball, and he thinks it's New York. New York is going to be the city he grows up in. He starts out in Queens. He's, in a certain way, my friend James McCourt is the Bard of Queens, next to Walt Whitman, perhaps?
Oh, gosh.
And what we see is that memory, depending on where you look at it, if you were slicing it open, it has so many points.
Yes.
Anatomy, yes. So many points of entry, so that you see the mother pathetic and old, the mother as a siren. I'll make a revelation. I heard Lasting City and I thought, wait, that's in the Bible. And the lasting city in the Bible, we have no lasting city. The lasting city is in heaven on the other side. Mm-hmm. And so this is about how everything is temporal and temporary. Mm-hmm. We want the lasting city, but it could go up in a fireball. Mm. Mm-hmm. We want to remember and tell everything, but it can go with a single epileptic attack.
Exactly.
The author discovers he's epileptic.
Yes.
And his hesitations in the book are the hesitations of someone who goes dead behind the eyes for a couple of seconds and then comes back. We're tracing a whole etiology of what personality is and how a writing and personal style evolve. Mm. Am I close?
Perfect. That's wonderful.
Oh, I'm so happy. Because, you know, it said...
But you always were. Are.
What are we... Are we talking?
Well, you see, it's always said that James McCourt's work is difficult. I don't think so. I think it's difficult if you don't read it. As soon as you start reading it and you start hearing the bits of the stories and putting it together, one of the people I work with, my assistant, a poet, Robert Dewhurst, said to me, you know what part one is, Michael? I said, no, tell me. He said, it's a Christmas carol. He's at his mother's bedside. She dies, and going home, he meets the ghosts of the past.
Good.
Yes. And I thought, yes, that's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in part two, we're introduced to the idea of interpretation, right? Texts and postmodernism, and we're not going to hear this from beginning to end because there is no beginning and there is no end. Mm-hmm. Why not?
I think possibly because of the epileptic condition and because of the fact that nobody knew, you know, what was wrong with this kid, you know. His self-image, his feeling about himself was that he was floating, that everybody else had been born and would die, and he somehow got the idea that when he would, you know, white out or whatever, as I remember it, he would just, like a vision, you know, and he very attracted early on to particularly the visions and the ecstasies of St. Teresa of Avila. And he could see himself rising up, as it often happens in dreams, you know, but where did he fit in?
So the boy, who is James McCourt, has epilepsy, but he experiences it as a religious vision, as a spiritual vision.
Yes.
And he's given an elevated position in which he can look at the lasting city, past, present, and future.
Yes.
And that's the position from which this book is written.
Yes, and the terror of its exploding.
Yes. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm talking to James McCourt, the author of Lasting City, And the thrill of this book is that in addition to what you just heard, this boy, the author, is gay and knows that he's gay from a very early age and tells us the almost day-by-day experience of what it's like to see partway through the door of a school urinal. A proctor or someone comes and says, close the door. And he says, I suffer from, what is that?
Amnesia?
No. He was the fear of closed spaces.
Oh, claustrophobia.
I suffer from claustrophobia is his explanation of why he can get to look at the other little boys across the way at the urinals. Now, no one has really told this story. This is the story of being young in what decade?
That would be 1947 through high school, 1958. Yeah, more in the earlier part. Yeah.
And we're finding out so many things, so many secrets that are no longer secrets.
Right.
And members of the family have always wondered. The older brother, David, who's seen the boy not looking carefully, almost hit by a car, and he says, if his brains were splattered on Polk Street, at least we'd know what goes on inside his head, because he was such a busy, complicated boy.
But he was also, David was also my hero, you know, and he, you know, he had these snappy things. And when he went to Korea, he was gone 2.5 years. I was so bereft. I was in love with him, and I kept hearing my cousin, who was about the same age, talking about the family romance. They were off reading Freud, you know. And I kept thinking, I'm involved in that. I love David, you know. And to this day, you know, he's my hero.
Well, let's hear a section of the book in which David appears, and in fact, you hear both the young boy and the older man spading up material, because in order to tell everything, this is not superficial digging. This is like digging the grave.
Mm. Yes, this is.
Digging deep and free associating, as in a therapist's office. And here we go. James McCourt reading a section from Lasting City.
The story of the growing child is a succession of stories, beginning with the stories read to him, the ones he hears on the radio, and the ones he learns to read himself, laying the foundation for a double life, which become as much a part of his story as any he brings back from school, or from up the street, or any told of him from adult to adult, especially those he overhears. Seasons on, how crestfallen to discover on the radio a woman called Fanny Bryce. There she was on the cover of the sheet music for her song, My Man. His mother called it a torch song. Why? Because she's carrying a torch for a man. Does smoke get in her eyes? Silence. Was she carrying the torch for him? Why can't he carry it himself? That's a good question, which meant he wasn't going to get an answer. There were two ways of knowing you'd get none. When they said, ask a silly question, you get a silly answer. And when they said, that's a good question. So his mother used to say, you couldn't win for losing. He asked David, his older brother, what does it mean, carrying a torch? Well, it could mean a lot of things. The Nazis carried torches waving swastikas in torchlight parades. We saw them in the newsreels. When the mob burns a guy's house down, the cops say they torched it. The rebels torch the wilderness to burn the Union soldiers to death. Englishmen call a flashlight a torch. You hear it in English movies. So if you were English, you went down the cellar to change a fuse or to show a frightened child there was no such thing as the boogeyman. It was pronounced boogie, as in that song he loved that the Andrews sisters sang, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy of Company B. But it was spelled B-O-G-E-Y, as in bogey, and Humphrey Bogart was bogey. You could ask them, the bogeys, to hold the torch for you while you change the fuse, if you knew how. Most things were if. There was also, his brother explained, the torch of the Olympics, first carried by relay runners from Marathon to Athens in ancient Greece, skipping them over centuries to the drama of the 1936 Munich Olympiad, and of Jesse Owens, the black track star, tall as a tree and swift as an antelope, making mincemeat and mockery of the Nazis' myth of the Superman, who in this case looked like Joe Palooka and didn't even wear a blue cape. Also, the English carried torches for Joan of Arc, but that was something else too. Oh. And there she was on the radio, Fanny Bryce, who, according to his grandfather, had been a great star of vaudeville, whatever vaudeville was anyway, and in the Ziegfeld Follies, ignorant people said Ziegfeld, playing a character called Baby Snooks, companioned by another infant called Robespierre. Eerie fascination and jealousy, as his family laughed on and on, his grandfather and his brother David in particular, wasn't he supposed to be the comedian? Did one have to be on the radio before anybody paid serious attention?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with James McCourt about his book, Lasting City, The Anatomy of Nostalgia. We'll continue after this short break.
This is Connie Alvarez. Bookworm is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station in Los Angeles. It costs money to put this program together. Please help support us by going to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with James McCourt about his book, Lasting City, The Anatomy of Nostalgia. As much the story of interpersonal memories as the story of the memories layered onto space and place. Now, the book, from this Christmas Carol-like opening, performs a kind of vertical dive,
yes,
into analysis, going back to the myth of Orestes, the story of the mutilated mother.
Mm-hmm.
It takes us way deep into a process that might be called a lecture or, yes, an anatomy. How do we interpret this overpowering amount of memory that is a human life?
Mm.
Because I think one of the great strengths of this book, Lasting City, in addition to understanding that everything is temporal and temporary, it understands that everything can be interpreted multiply, mm-hmm. understood in so many different ways, and that the final understanding is the intersection point of all the different ways.
Somebody said as I was writing this book, and I was having a lot of emotional reactions to the work, and he said, I don't know, as if I care to lie down in an open grave between my mother and my father.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. What allowed you to continue to do that, to write a book of this sort?
It was an order.
Tell everybody.
I felt it was an order, you know, and I kept seeing that dying woman. One of the nurses said, oh, she was a nice lady. I said, excuse me, she was not a nice lady. She was strong, intelligent. I said, nice ladies finish last, same as nice guys. But she was Filipino and she didn't understand what I was talking about.
But I love that because it is natural. She says, she must have been a nice lady for you to be willing to spend day and night next to her for the 3 days of her death. And Kitty Moore has said in her movie star persona, it's a nice place to spend 3 days before you die. And, you know, she's quite a grandstander.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Now,
Mirabile dictu, she'd say. Or concedo hoc. And I was once talking to Susan Sontag, and she said, your mother said things like that? I said, well, Susan, all those young girls took Latin in high school. And, you know, they'd say things like that. And Susan said, I wish I'd had a mother who said things like that.
Yes. Well, I think, you see, my mother took Latin in high school, too. And, you know, she would amoa masa madre.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that was, for us, wasn't it, the sign that an education meant learning so much, so mm-hmm. much. If your own mother could scold you in Latin, what were you going to have to know in order to be a functioning, intelligent adult?
Yeah.
What was the limit?
Yeah.
And then with the books that we were hearing about at the time, James Joyce's Ulysses, books in which you must know everything, which is a title by Isaac Babel. Mm-hmm. You must know everything.
Yeah.
And that is another command that underwrites mm-hmm. Lasting City. You must know everything because in order for it to last, it's all going to disappear.
Mm.
Only what you write down will last. And so the book is the Lasting City.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's what you have in your hands, is, you know, the Lasting City.
Now, James, let me ask you, since this book, it's the first time I've seen it, you attempt to write sentences that include memory loss, so that the sentences sometimes stutter, sometimes fumble, sometimes extinguish. Mm-hmm. And it's so beautiful because that sound is metrical.
Mm-hmm.
The rhythm of failing memory becomes the poetry of Lasting City.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, poetry has been an important part of my life, although I've never published any. Many poet friends, etc., like that. But there are things that I knew I could do in prose that were metrical, you know, in ways that ordinary prose, you know, accepted prose weren't. And I, you know, without being in the 50s, there were a lot of, you know, very crazy books, you know, a lot of strange and crazy books. And
what were some of them? Naked Lunch, for instance?
Something, what was it called? Jigsaw. I don't remember exactly, but they were, and they never appealed to me at all. Whereas Ulysses, I said, what's difficult about this book? You're reading a book, and then somebody is in there talking, and it's in your head, And I said, and it's even mocked at the very beginning where he's talking about metempsychosis. And she says, ah, rocks, tell us in plain words.
Yes.
But I've always had the notion that, that I could, you know, some of my sentences could scan, you know, as if they were iambic or hendosyllabic and whatnot, you know.
I've read all of your books. This
yes.
is your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th
book.
And I don't think you've ever done anything like this,
no, I
really.
Haven't.
It really is the sound of the music of memory.
Mm.
And when it goes into analysis, mm-hmm. it's not analysis. The character is dreaming analysis. It doesn't make regular sense. It's as if he's going through psychoanalysis in a dream. And the revelations are not so much coherent, they are incoherent. They're vatic. They're prophetic. They're
yes.
very...
Vatic is a nice term.
Yes, isn't it?
Even if it does invoke the Vatican, but that's all right.
But I really felt that, you know, there are a lot of writers who are trying to do the things that... the modernists
yes.
did.
Mm-hmm.
But this really is something not only from beyond waking cognition, but also from beyond the grave.
Yes.
It's peopled by ghosts,
uh-huh.
and New York City becomes a city of the dead, a necropolis.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, congratulations.
Thank you. It was worth a couple of nervous breakdowns.
I'll say, I truly recommend it. It's Lasting City, The Anatomy of Nostalgia by my guest, James McCourt, published by LiveWrite. Thank you, James, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael, as always.
You can comment on today's show from Lasting City, The Anatomy of Nostalgia, at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. Bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when critic Dennis Scheck is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.